This episode's audio was generated using AI technology. You know, usually when we talk about operating systems, there's this this expectation of an ironclad border, like a massive impenetrable concrete wall separating your messy application code from the pristine, highly privileged core of the operating system.
Right, the classic user space, kernel space divide.
Exactly. You make a system call, you politely hand your ticket to the guard at the gate, you wait your turn, and the kernel handles the hardware execution for you. I mean, it's clean.
Yeah, and it's safe.
Yeah.
It is literally the absolute foundation of modern computing security and stability and, you know, memory isolation.
Yeah.
You really don't want a rogue pointer in your web server tearing down the disk control.
No, definitely not. But then you step into the world of hyperscale cloud environments and massive AI workloads, and suddenly that concrete wall is looking a lot more like a chain link fence.
Yeah, it really is.
And in some research labs, they are actively taking a bulldozer to it. So welcome to another episode of Kernel Panic. Whether you're debugging a flaky microservice on a Tuesday afternoon, orchestrating a massive Kubernetes cluster, or tuning a low-level C++ rendering engine, today's topic hits the absolute core of how your code actually talks to the hardware.
Because we are looking at a fundamental architectural shift, the boundary between user space and kernel space is evolving. And in some models, it's violently crumbling under the sheer unyielding pressure for performance and minimal latency.
To explore this, we've stacked up a massive pile of sources today. We're looking at a deep bench of tech news, release notes, and kernel mailing list discussions covering the brand new Linux 6.16 kernel that's pulling from ZDNet, OMG, Ubuntu, Egalia, Kernel Newbies, and Reddit.
Quite the stack.
Yeah, and we also have a highly detailed engineering blog post from Microsoft's Linux Systems Group. And finally, a completely fascinating, if slightly terrifying, master's thesis out of Boston University by Frederick L.J. Wilk about a concept called dynamic privilege.
Which is just a perfect progression for this discussion. We're going to start with the traditional, incremental ways system engineers try to squeeze performance out of the Linux kernel. Then we'll move into how massive AI workloads are forcing us to bypass the kernel entirely for networking and storage. And finally, we'll explore Wilk's academic framework, which essentially turns the entire Linux kernel into a shared object library for your user applications.
It gets wild. But let's start with Linux 6.16. There is a highly discussed new kconfig build option that just dropped, which is config's x86 native UCPU.
Right, I saw that.
Basically, if you enable this in your kernel config, it applies the nmarch native compiler flag to the kernel C code and an nmarch C target CP native to its Rust code. And the goal here is to optimize the build for the exact local CPU architecture it's being compiled on.
Exactly. It allows GCC or Clang to use specific instruction sets and, you know, pipeline optimizations that are unique to the physical silicon sitting right there on your motherboard.
Rather than a generic build.
Right. Rather than compiling a generic by 8664 binary that has to maintain backward compatibility with CPUs from a decade ago.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I want to challenge the hype here a little bit. Looking through the Reddit discussions in our sources, low-level developers are pointing out that the actual performance gains from this flag vary from a measly 0.2% to maybe 3.3% in specific micro benchmarks.
Isn't that huge?
That is like adding a carbon fiber racing spoiler to a Honda Civic commuter car. Why is it so low? Because people see nmarch native and they assume it's a magic speed button that unlocks a massive vectorized loop unrolling.
It's a great question, and it really comes down to what the kernel actually does versus what a user space application does.
Mm-hmm.
When you compile user space binaries with that flag, the compiler can heavily leverage wide vector registers for data crunching.
Right.
But the kernel operates on an entirely different set of constraints.
Because of the context switching overhead, right?
Yeah, precisely. The kernel's primary job is multiplexing resources. If the kernel were to actively use those massive AVX512 vector registers to do its own internal work, it would have to say the state of those massive registers.
Every single time it switches contexts.
Exactly. Every single time it switches context between different user processes, it has to save them and then restore them. Saving hundreds of bytes of vector state on every single switch to call is computationally expensive.
Oh, wow.
It's so expensive that the Linux kernel explicitly disables floating point and vector instructions in kernel mode. It uses compiler flags like abno and abnofx just to keep those context switches fast. So most of the magic March Native brings to the table is completely off limits to the kernel anyway.
So the compiler is mostly just doing what micro optimizations, like instruction scheduling, maybe utilizing a few newer bit manipulation instructions, but nothing earth shattering.
Yes, exactly. But what's fascinating here is that context matters. Yeah. You might scoff at a 3% gain on a single local server.
Sure.
But at a hyperscale cloud level, think Microsoft Azure or AWS, a 3% performance gain across 10 million physical cores translates to massive reductions in power consumption, cooling, and raw hardware costs.
Okay, fair point. Yeah. At scale, that's millions of dollars.
Exactly. And more importantly, Linux 6.16 is laying the groundwork for some serious next-generation hardware upgrades. For example, it introduces support for Intel's Advanced Performance Extensions, or APX.
Which is powering the new Lunar Lake and Granite Rapids architectures, right?
Right. And APX is a massive architectural shift because it actually doubles the number of general purpose by 86 registers from 16 to 32.
Oh, wow.
That is a huge deal. It means the compiler can keep way more variables in fast hardware registers rather than constantly spilling them out to the stack and main memory. So optimizing the kernel to actually know those 32 registers exist is crucial.
That makes sense.
But to your earlier point, if you want real performance multipliers, we're talking 2x or 3x gains, not 3%, you can't just rely on compiler flags. You have to destroy the traditional network and storage bottlenecks entirely.
Which brings us perfectly to the data path optimizations we're seeing in Linux 6.16. Because if the CPU context switch and the user kernel boundary are the bottlenecks, the modern engineering solution seems to be just get the CPU out of the way entirely.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is all about zero copy architecture and hardware offloading. How do we move data from point A to point B without the host CPU having to wake up, touch the data, copy it into a kernel socket buffer, and copy it back into user space?
Right. And the 6.16 release notes are full of this stuff. They introduced the new OpenVPN data channel offload, or DCO, which pushes the core cryptographic data operations directly into kernel space to avoid bouncing packets back and forth via the TUNTAP interfaces. Mm-hmm. But the really crazy one is device memory TCP. This allows zero copy transmission of TCP payloads directly from a GPU's memory using the DMBUF framework straight out to the network wire.
And that is massive for AI workloads. When you're training these huge neural networks across distributed clusters, you're moving terabytes of tensor weights between GPUs.
Right.
Historically, the GPU had to transfer that data over the PCIe bus into the host CPU's system memory. Then the CPU had to process it through the traditional Linux TCP/IP stack and push it back over the PCIe bus to the network interface card. You absolutely choke the entire system bus doing that.
I was reading the Microsoft Linux Systems group blog on this, and it's a perfect real-world example of attacking this bottleneck. To handle these massive AI models on Azure, Microsoft engineers had to completely re-architect the receive path, the RX path of their MNA network driver.
Which is a smart NIC, right?
Exactly, the driver for the Microsoft Azure Network Adapter. By eliminating wasted memory allocations and implementing aggressive buffer recycling, they achieved 2x higher effective network throughput on 64 kilobyte page systems. Two times.
It's insane.
And 35% better memory efficiency.
And keep in mind, that is without upgrading the physical network cable or the underlying hardware. That is purely software efficiency, achieved by bypassing the bloated traditional paths. It's the exact same philosophy behind frameworks like DPDK, the Data Plane Development Kit, or eBPF.
Right. Let's talk about how those actually work under the hood, because they are prime examples of this shift. DPDK completely takes over the network card, right?
Exactly. So normally, a network card receives a packet and fires a hardware interrupt. The CPU stops what it's doing, switches context to the kernel, hands in the interrupt, and copies the packet.
Which is slow.
Very slow. DPDK says no more interrupts. It unbinds the NIC from the standard kernel network driver and binds it to a user space driver. Then it maps the NIC's memory directly into the user application's memory space.
Wow.
The application just burns a CPU core in a continuous while loop, aggressively polling a ring buffer for new packets. Zero context switches, zero interrupts.
And then eBPF attacks it from the other direction. Instead of pulling the hardware up into user space, it pushes user logic down into the kernel.
Yep.
You write a small C program, compile it to bytecode, and the kernel securely sandboxes it and attaches it directly to the lowest levels of the network stack. You can drop or redirect packets before the kernel even allocates a socket buffer.
It makes me think of your restaurant analogy.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, so the traditional user kernel divide is like a waiter, which is the CPU, having to walk every single plate of food from the chef, the GPU, all the way out to the customer, which is the network card.
Right.
And the waiter has to physically push through these swinging double doors, the context switch, every single time. What Linux 6.16 device memory, TCP, DPDK, and eBPF are doing is basically tearing down the swinging doors and installing a conveyor belt straight from the oven to the customer's table.
An excellent analogy.
Yeah.
But here is the catch. These are all highly specialized piecemeal bypasses.
How so?
Well, DPDK requires rewriting your entire application to use its specific polling libraries. eBPF is strictly sandboxed and limited in what it can actually execute. They solve very specific problems for very specific workloads, like AI networking or high-frequency trading, but they don't solve the fundamental overhead of the user kernel divide for general software.
Ah, I see.
Every other standard PO6 application, your databases, your message queues, is still waiting on that waiter to push through the swinging doors.
Which sets us up for the ultimate question. If context switches, system calls, and kernel boundaries are so inherently expensive, what if a user application could just become the kernel on demand?
Right.
What if it could just, you know, put on the chef's hat, grab the data, and bypass the doors entirely?
And that brings us to Frederick L.J. Wilkes' master's thesis from Boston University.
This thesis completely blew my mind. It outlines a framework called dynamic privilege and a mechanism called kernel shortcuts, or K-cuts. To really understand why this is a massive leap forward, we have to talk about unikernels first.
Yeah, that's vital context.
Previously, research projects like Unikernel Linux or UKL proved you could get insane performance by combining your application and the kernel into one single, highly privileged binary. No context switches, direct hardware access.
But the developer experience for unikernel is notoriously a nightmare.
A total nightmare. You have to statically link everything at compile time. You can't use standard dynamic libraries. It requires a horrific custom build process that breaks standard Linux debugging tooling, profilers, and deployment pipelines. But Wilkes' thesis proposes something entirely different, which is libcallsims.caress.
This is where the architecture gets incredibly clever. libcallsims.caress is a user space library that literally exposes the running Linux kernel's symbol table to standard user space dynamic linkers.
Let me just emphasize this for you listening, because it is wild. This means the actual live Linux kernel is being treated exactly like any other shared object library on your file system.
Just like lib.
Just like lib or libthread. You can write an application that dynamically links to interior kernel functions at runtime. Wilk designed a hybrid build and binary model HBB. Basically, a developer builds a fat binary. This binary contains your normal, everyday user executable, but it also contains a kernel extension packaged as a standard .curl kernel module.
And the magic happens the exact moment the application launches. When the standard Linux dynamic linker, ld.so, tries to load this app into memory, it triggers a custom dynamic privileged load linker. Mm-hmm. This load linker actually makes a system call to load your .curl module into kernel space, and then it dynamically patches the global offset table, the GOT, in your user application.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the GOT patching is the secret sauce. Normally, when your binary calls a function like read, it jumps to the procedure linkage table, which looks up an address in the global offset table.
Right.
That address usually points to a wrapper function in glib, which sets up the CPU registers and executes the syscall instruction to trap into the kernel.
Right, that's the standard flow. But with Wilk's framework, when the kernel module loads, it returns the actual physical virtual memory addresses of the kernel's internal routines. Mm-hmm. The load linker takes those ring zero memory addresses and overwrites the entries in your user application's GOT.
So when your user code calls read, it doesn't execute a syscall instruction at all. It just executes a standard jump instruction straight into the kernel's interior sysread routine.
Exactly. It resolves the memory addresses dynamically at load time, seamlessly merging the two address spaces.
But I have to push back here. This is terrifying from a systems engineering standpoint. Isn't this like giving a random theme park guest a master key to the high voltage maintenance tunnels?
It really is.
If my user application is executing a sysread shortcut directly in hardware ring 0 and it tries to dereference a null pointer, doesn't that fundamentally compromise the entire operating system?
Oh, it's absolutely dangerous. If the application crashes while its thread is executing in ring 0, the hardware traps the fault in kernel mode. It takes the entire operating system down with it.
Total kernel panic.
Total panic. There is no isolation. But this isn't meant for your web browser or your music player. This is designed for dedicated, high-performance runtimes like in-memory databases, Redis caches, specialized microservices, where latency is the only metric that matters. And what Wilk argues is that this is an additive, optional runtime property.
Meaning you can opt in?
Right. It merges the incredible bare metal speed of a unikernel with the safety and familiar tooling of the standard Linux ecosystem. You build your app using normal GCC or Clang. You use standard libraries. But in the hot paths, the parts of your code that are just begging for performance, you can optionally elevate to kernel privilege, patch the GOT, and bypass the system call overhead entirely.
Okay, I get the theory, but I want the war stories. Because you can't just casually blur the line between ring 3 user space and ring kernel space without breaking things at the silicon level. The thesis goes into some intense production incidents and debugging nightmares they faced while building this framework.
And this is where we see the human side of engineering. When you try to outsmart decades of established operating system architecture, the hardware itself fights back.
Let's talk about the red zone memory hazard. This is so fascinating to me. In the System V AMD 64 ABI, which is the standard calling convention for by 8664, there is an optimization specifically for the stack.
Yes.
Functions are allowed to use a 128-byte area of memory directly below the current stack pointer, called the red zone, without formally allocating it by moving the stack pointer.
It's a really clever compiler trick to save a few instructions. Since nothing else is supposed to be executing on that stack, it's perfectly safe to throw temporary local variables down there.
Right. But enter dynamic privilege. Imagine your application is running in user space, using a standard user stack. It uses the elevate instruction to gain ring 0 kernel hardware privileges, but it stays on its user stack to execute a quick kernel shortcut. Suddenly, an asynchronous hardware interrupt occurs, like a network packet arriving or a CPU timer going off.
The hardware looks at the current CPU state. It sees that the processor is currently in ring 0 kernel mode. So according to the CPU's hardwired silicon logic, it assumes it is perfectly safe to handle the interrupt right there on the current stack.
And so the hardware blindly pushes a 6-quad-word exception frame directly onto the user stack to save the state before handling the interrupt. And what gets overwritten?
The 128 by red zone.
Boom! Your function's temporary variables are instantly corrupted by the hardware itself. The app crashes, and because it currently holds kernel privileges, the whole system dies.
Yep.
And it gets worse. What if your user stack pointer happens to be pointing at a page of memory that hasn't been physically mapped yet by the MMU?
Oh, the double fault scenario Wilk describes.
Yeah.
Yeah, in normal user space, if you hit an unmapped page on the stack, it's fine. It triggers a page fault exception. The kernel's memory management unit allocates the physical page, updates the page tables, and you carry on.
But if a hardware interrupt happens while you are dynamically elevated to kernel mode, and the hardware tries to push that exception frame onto an unmapped page, the CPU physically cannot write the frame.
Right.
So it triggers a page fault. But to handle the page fault, it has to push another exception frame onto the stack, which is still unmapped.
Which triggers a double fault. And in by 86 architecture, a double fault is generally a fatal error. The machine just halts.
It is a beautiful disaster. Solving one bottleneck creates a cascade of low-level architecture traps. So how did they fix it? If the hardware is hardwired to push that exception frame onto the current stack, you can't just tell it to stop. You'd have to physically redirect it at the CPU level. Wait, is that what the IST does? Does it act like a hardware override?
Exactly. The solution is a masterclass in low-level engineering. They implemented an exception frame buffer, or EFB, by heavily modifying the hardware's interrupt dispatching structures using the interrupt stack table, or IST.
How does the IST actually work under the hood?
So the IST is a feature within the by 86 task state segment. Normally, the CPU decides where to put the exception frame based on your privilege level transitions. By configuring the IST, they essentially programmed a hardware override into the CPU itself.
Wow.
They forced the hardware to universally redirect the exception frame to a safe, pinned, dedicated page of memory that is strictly isolated per CPU core.
So it acts as a staging buffer.
Precisely. The hardware safely dumps the exception frame into this buffer without ever touching the user stack or risking a red zone corruption. Then, a common interrupt handler kicks in, evaluates the actual state of the system like. Was the thread dynamically elevated? Was it using a user stack? Is the stack fully mapped?
Right, figuring out the context.
Exactly. And then it safely copies that exception frame to the correct safe location before allowing the kernel to process the interrupt.
That is brilliant.
But this raises an important question, though, about the sheer paranoia required to architect this. It didn't stop at the stack. They had to implement strict idempotency for privilege transitions, because the Linux kernel assumes certain things are universally true at all times.
Like what?
Take the GS segment register, for example. The kernel relies heavily on the G's register to quickly access per CPU data structures. And it fundamentally assumes that the state of the G's register perfectly matches the current privilege mode of the CPU.
Ah, so if you are transitioning from user space to kernel space dynamically via a K-cut, there is a split second, just a few clock cycles, where you have kernel hardware privileges, but your G's register hasn't been swapped via the swaps instruction yet.
Right. And if a hardware interrupt fires in that exact nanosecond window,
the kernel's interrupt handler tries to read its per CPU data using a user space G's register, reads absolute garbage memory, and panics the machine.
Precisely. So the elevate transition has to be bulletproof. It has to explicitly mask out hardware interrupts, execute the swap leaks instruction, and, this is crucial, ensure the transition code doesn't cross a memory page boundary.
Wait, why the page boundary?
Because if the instruction pointer crosses a page boundary, it could trigger an instruction fetch page fault while the CPU is in that inconsistent state, which, again, results in a kernel panic.
It is amazing. Just the amount of human ingenuity, deep architectural knowledge, and sheer grit required to bend the operating system to do something it desperately was never designed to do.
But the performance numbers in the thesis make it worth it for the right applications. It's all about giving developers the control to make those extreme trade-offs when latency is critical.
So what does this all mean? We have taken a massive journey today. We started with the modest 3% gains of the x86 native eCPU compiler flags in Linux 6.16. We scaled up to the massive zero-copy DMABUHEF offloads and DPDK polling powering Azure AI networks. And we ended in the mind-bending reality of dynamically linking the kernel directly into your application at runtime with libcallsims.so.
The underlying theme here is that the infrastructure beneath your code is actively blurring the traditional lines of the operating system. It has to, in order to deliver the scale and speed modern applications demand.
You see it everywhere. Even in that Microsoft blog post, they casually mentioned merging KEXEC handover, or KHO, into Linux 6.16.
KHO is a perfect example of this blurring.
It's incredible. For those who haven't tracked it, KEXEC handover is a mechanism that preserves memory state across a kernel reboot. Normally, if you use KEXEC to boot a new kernel without going through the BIOS, the new kernel wipes the memory clean.
Right, a fresh slate.
But KHO introduces a serialization protocol. The old running kernel builds a flattened device tree, an FDT blob, containing the state of vital subsystems, like the exact memory pages of running QEMU virtual machines or active network sockets.
Then it boots the new kernel, passes it the FDT blob, and the new kernel parses it. Instead of initializing those memory regions as free space, it actively claims them and reconnects the user space processes.
Which is wild.
It allows Azure to update the base Linux kernel on the fly without rebooting customer VMs or tearing down TCP connections. The boundaries of what constitutes a reboot are dissolving.
Yeah.
Which leaves us with a fascinating and maybe slightly provocative thought to mull over. We have spent 50 years building general-purpose operating systems with rigid boundaries, system call interfaces, and strict memory isolation.
Mm.
But if user space applications can now dynamically elevate to hardware ring and zero privileges, bypass the network stack entirely via eBPF and DPDK, and link directly to kernel symbols on the fly,
yeah.
What does the concept of a general-purpose OS even mean a decade from now?
Oh, man.
Are we moving toward a future where the OS as a massive, monolithic guard at the gate ceases to exist? A future where every application is just a bespoke, modular unikernel, assembling its own customized operating system at runtime out of shared libraries.
The chain link fence isn't just coming down. The whole castle is being sold for parts to build custom race cars. It's an incredible space to watch. Thank you all for tuning in to another episode of Kernel Panic. Until next time, keep your stack corners safe and watch out for those red zones.